This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of the world's funniest comedians. This is Comedy Goldmines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome, world. Welcome to Comedy Goldmines. God damn it. I'll say it again, and I'm going to say it with a little more feeling and a little more passion. Welcome to Comedy Goldmines, where we do what? Well, we get inside the minds of amazing comedians. And today will be no different because we got a great mind. We got a mind with history. We got a legend. We got David Spade in the goddamn building.
David Spade, very close to you. Kevin, you're a great dude. You're a very upbeat guy I see out in the world. And love talking to you, actually.
Man, you know what? I didn't know. I'm going to start off. I didn't know you were a fucking car guy.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah.
I didn't know.
Actually, Barrett Jackson is a car auction that I have two cars in this year. And they might have said, do you have anything in Barrett? Or have you? I don't know if they said your name.
I bought a car from Barrett. Mm-hmm. Barrett has its pros and cons.
Yeah.
And the car that I bought is a 59 Corvette.
Okay.
Mint green, fucking great car. But I ended up doing a bunch of shit to it and putting the car in like mint condition. So
yeah.
But I like build cars from the ground up. Like that's my real hobby. Like that's really what I do.
So you know the hard part sometimes for me is like if we're talking about cars, like I get everyone sort of has their section of cars they like. I sort of like those old Mopar sort of early 70s.
I'm a Mopar guy.
And they're cool and we use them in movies. And then I was looking at them and I kind of dug them. I got into them more. We had one in a lot of these movies. So the hard part is I don't know enough mechanically. So it's a little, I'm just this rich actor that comes in and swipes it and everyone gets mad. And one time I bought a Grand National and this super cool dude had it forever. And he met me at like the Vons parking lot. And he's like, oh, it's you? And I'm like, yeah. And I'm going around. I go, it's pretty nice. He goes, yeah. By the way, when you clean the air conditioner, there's these special Q-tips to get in the vents. I go, yeah, all good, guy. I got it. And he goes, you're not going to. I go, I don't give a fuck, dude. I'm just going to buy it and drive it and drive it into the ground. And he's like, but this is my baby. I go, that's the bummer. Once you sell it, it's over. But I do like the cars, but the Grand National, I drove a lot. And I thought it was cool. It's
I got a Grand National.
Oh, you do?
I have a Grand. Yeah,
aren't
I got a GNX.
Sweet? Yeah. Oh, a GNX. Oh.
Yeah, GNX.
A little nice.
I'm a collector, man.
Yeah.
I'm real. 537 made or 500 made. I think I got number 228. I got about 2,000 miles on it, maybe.
It's solid right in the middle somewhere where it's somewhere all, they right know how to build middle. Them. They got it right. They got it
right,
down.
Right in the fucking
middle,
got
the kinks
middle,
out. Yeah, it's hard because if they're so nice, sometimes like I drove, I had a 69 Hemi Daytona 4-speed. And it's like one of those Joe Dirt cars, the big whale tail in the back. And it was just hard because they have the original tires. Everything was original. And I'm going up La Siena, guy, you know, I used to be a valet. I know how to drive a stick, but it gets the wobs on the freeway. It's not built like a Tesla goes way faster, you know?
So what I do is I'm a pro touring builder. So I get the old cars, but I modify the inside of the car
Resto
to run
mod.
Like
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of the cars from the outside, they give you every bit of old school, old
all the
feel.
Fun you like, yeah.
And you don't go crazy in the inside, like when it tears, you don't make it look ridiculous so that if you ever did want to sell it, you couldn't. You just do the resto to the point where everything is modern enough for today. So right. Fuel injection, your intakes, the motor, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like it's something that can run forever. But that's my fucking hobby. And I found out because of Barrett Jackson that you were there. I knew that you put cars in there to go this year.
Yeah,
I was like, I had no idea that David was a car guy. And it just, you know, it just adds a little bit of excitement about me already being a fan. You know?
Yeah. The last one was a 68 Chevelle and it was a resto mod and I've never had those, but I got it about a year or two ago and it had an LS3 Corvette engine. It was really super pimp sled and actually too cool for me, but it was so nice that, and I'm moving and I didn't have a place for it. And I said, all right, I'll get rid of it. And then I'll just, you know, the fun about the car thing is you can just go back and find another one or build
find
one
another
or
one.
You want.
There you go. Let's talk about you and the legend that you are, man. David Spade, you are not only a successful comedian, you're a successful comedic actor, television and film. Right.
Ooh,
and this is a big deal. It's a big deal because you are what a lot of comics have referred to or looked at as one of the guys that did it right. Holy shit, man. How the fuck did he land these jobs after jobs after jobs after jobs after jobs? And it's almost now, I don't know. Is there a sitcom Hall of Fame? Do they have one?
Yeah, I'm trying to get one going. There isn't, but you know, I did have some success in that, and it was never really the plan, but I remember seeing Three's Company and those things growing up because I'm older than you. And when you see those, and it just looks like fun, you know, to be on a sitcom. And I love comedies growing up. But I never dreamt big enough to be on a sitcom. I never dreamt big enough to be like a star or to be even in movies or anything. It was just, I was a dishwasher. I was a valet. I was a busboy. And I just, I grew up in the mean streets of Scottsdale, Arizona. Actually, it's pretty nice there, but they did have streets. And they weren't that mean, but I grew up there, but we were kind of broke in a nice area, which is a weird scene, you know?
You're but like, I understand broke. It. I know
but
exactly what
you
mean.
You know what I mean? And it's okay because your friends have money, but you feel stupid sometimes. My mom and my two brothers all shared a car, you know, and it had different dents in it from each of us smashing it. But, you know, then you do, that's just a normal way to grow up. And the dad wasn't around. And so basically my big dreams were, maybe go to college or maybe just find something I like to do. And when I started doing stand-up, my big dream was to just make enough so I didn't have to borrow money from people. Just like I could just do my thing on my own.
Did you stumble into stand-up?
Yeah, I did. I don't know how you did it, but I finished school, high school, and then everyone went off to college and I didn't. I stayed and went to community college.
Ah, we share sort similarities, my friend.
Loser vibe, I guess. But I didn't think of it. I was like, I was kind of smart. This is the word I try to get out there. But I was smart until high school and then I got a little bit of a social life. And so I dropped it. I sort of wanted to have fun.
Okay.
And I always thought, well, I did great from kindergarten, eighth grade. They know I'm smart. But once it counted and people were writing it down, it didn't matter. You know, that's when it matters.
I'm right there with
you. It's the same
scene. I'm right there with you. You know, in high school, you know, the social life, the idea of friends and going out as a guy who had some popularity and had some really strong relationships with nice people, I chose to prioritize that. Like that's what I wanted. And you know, to everybody listening, there's nothing wrong with being a social butterfly, but the choice of putting education second definitely isn't the best one. Unfortunately, I mean, it worked out. I can't.
I know we're two bad examples.
Yes, two very bad examples. I'm trying to say something good. We're not the best people to speak on this particular thing. But I did the same thing. All my friends went to college. And
I was left there. I was stranded. I by the way, in seventh grade, I was doing math club and chess, you know, tournaments and spelling bees and then reading books. And then literally my brother was cool. All the schools merged together and I had a second life because they were like, oh, you're Andy's brother. Oh, so you're cool. You're a skateboarder. You got blonde hair. And I was like, oh, no, not really. And I had long blonde hair. And then my school was going, no, wait, he's a nerd. He's a loser. And it was too late. It was like wildfire. The new merging schools decided I was cool. And then I just ran with it. And I did not look back.
I'm laughing because the same thing. I had an older brother. Older brother was the cool brother. Everybody always referred to my older brother, right? Not me. Yeah. Oh, that's Rob Hart's brother. That's Lil Rob Hart. Oh, man, we love Lil Rob Hart.
Yeah. Minnie Spade.
My name
Minnie
for a Spade. Long time.
Yeah, and then my girls, cheerleaders that liked him would talk to me. Basically, I didn't realize to get to him.
Yeah.
Because he was like the cooler skater and he had like brown hair, but it was bleached, kind of blonde. And well, I did have a lot of components of a cool person. I was kind of tan back then. Mm-hmm. I was a skateboarder. I had, OP shirts, long white hair, and absolutely no game. And no money, but I was skateboarding. And the first day of freshman year, I broke both wrists skateboarding in a pool. So I walked in with two wrists and I looked cool. Wow. Accidentally. Everyone's like, who's this motherfucker?
Yeah, he's got to be badass.
Maybe he's regulating some shit on the streets of Scottsdale.
Are you and your brother really close?
You know, I have an older brother other than him, but Andy is great. I've always looked up to him. Brian is great. He's older than Andy. And we all, you know, we're trying to be pretty tight growing up because the dad scrammed on us. So, yeah. But my dad started popping back once in a while. And but he was getting the whiffs of some fame. You know, I was locally a teensy bit famous. The story was I went to my community college. The funny part was, Kevin, is I'd go back to, you know, everyone left, all my friends, which is a weird thing. My mom told me in high school at the graduation, be nice because some of these people you'll never see again in your life. I was like, what? And it's so true. I didn't know that. I go, I always have friends around. Everyone scatters. I go to community college and I'm so bored. I go back to my high school and sit on the wall at lunch.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Not
it's so
that
cringy.
Guy. Not that.
And everyone's
guy.
Like, I'm like, yeah, man. And everyone's like, hey, remember when the college guys used to come sit on the wall and they were losers? I go, yeah, those losers. I didn't even get it. I'm like, I couldn't even connect it. Like, well, that's them. I'm not.
Yeah. That's not. Wait, that's not me. I'm not. I'm that committee.
And it was so fucking gross. But then I got through that. Then I saw a comedy night in a paper and I go, what's that? You know, just out of boredom and liking seeing people on not SNL, but, you know, SNL and also like on talk shows doing stand up, you know. And I go, oh, fuck, I'd like to go watch it in real life. Mm-hmm. And so I went to this club called Chuckles, classic, stupid fucking name. And, but it was kind of a big club in Arizona. And then I watched, I was too young to get in, but I walked in and I was like, holy shit, are these guys making this up? It was so fun to see everyone just throwing out shit. And then I go, oh my God, I came another week. And then they had an amateur night. I go, what if I just, never crossed my mind. What if I did this? Because I did some talent shows in high school and we were always trying to be funny. But there's no one in Arizona is doing it, obviously. And that was sort of a good trick. And that was sort of why I got a little flirted with once in a while in those early years of virginity, because wasn't much clicking in high school, I'll tell you that. No TV shows. So it was just real deal and it was not working. And then I get a little bit of like, I'm just at a comedy club and someone heard that and they're like, oh, that's cool. It just seemed kind of cool and different. And to women, I think that's interesting that I was breaking the norm of whatever every other guy was doing. A lot of guys were going to construction and doing this. And I'm like, I got to run to the comedy club. And they're like, what? Like on TV? Like, and I was like, I'm just trying it. And they, so I did that and I started doing it at a club around Scottsdale. And then it turned into like a fun comedy night where friends would come and
yeah.
And then I go, oh, this is turning into a cool thing. I wasn't that good, but at least I was doing it and did it with a partner for a while. And then he was too stoned one night and he couldn't do it. And I go, I'm still going.
And you kept going.
And then
fucking similarities.
Oh, really?
Or yes. I had like a partner that was there with me in the beginning too. And I was traveling back and forth from Philadelphia to New York. And I was like, dude, this is it. Like, this is where, this is the work that we have to do. This is how it pays off. We gotta commit. We gotta be the engine to the car. We gotta wanna do it every day. And then he just fell off. And I was like, I'm not gonna do it. I'm gonna keep going.
Yeah, my engine conked out too. He was blowing bowls in the corner going, we can do this next week. And I go, no. And by the way, being motivated when nothing's clicking is the hardest thing in the world. That's for your viewers. Like, that's the hardest thing.
It's the hardest. So at some point, right, you're now doing it, you now fall in love with it. And by the way, I love the backstory. So just doing a little recap. So your dad wasn't around, but you and your brothers, fuck, man, you know what? We don't have a father, we got each other.
Yeah.
You figured it out. You guys are close. I assume very close to your mother.
Yeah. Yeah.
Supportive of you and your career throughout.
Yeah.
The decision to do comedy, was she like, oh my God, this is the best thing, or I believe in you, or was there hesitation at any point?
Only hesitation of like, can you still do some school? Because in case, you know, we want you to have schooling, they all do. Everyone wants you to have an education. So I was going to school. And then I went to Arizona State, which turns out is harder than a community college. And then I joined a fraternity.
Ooh.
And that was the end of it because it was so hard. I can't even be like pro fraternity. And I know they're all going to hate me, but it's just so hard and so much hazing and so detrimental that I thought, what is the fucking point? I get that it's cool, but all that just to be in a room with a bunch of girls that are in a sorority and drinking. And when you don't do it, everyone in your school is like, oh, you're not in a fraternity. There's nothing you can do then because everything revolves around it.
As a guy, I'm not in the fraternity either. I never went through the hazing or never tried. I was in community for 2 weeks. But the point and what I believe that's attached to it is, you know, look, it's about the brotherhood or sisterhood that lasts for a lifetime.
Hopefully, and yeah.
That's the connective tissue that's supposed to come.
That's the pitch
from the fraternities in that particular world. So, you know, and I think over the course of time, the hazing and stuff is kind of toned down. It's not what it once was. I think because more people got vocal and there was some situations about it. But I do know it's supposed to be I just graduated. I'm going to call some of our other frat brother connections.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like LinkedIn, you go, these guys will help me.
Yes. And we're supposed to be able to do blah, blah, blah.
They're in real estate also. I'm in real estate. That is the ideal situation. And I think that does still work. Mm-hmm. So just my particular old school, like getting calls at 2 a.m, come pick up River Rocks and bring them in and they're going to pour oil on you and paprika. And then we're going to make you scream and do pushups and shots. And on a school night, all the time. Like I started failing out. I go, I can't do that and stand up and school. And I had a job at a clothing store. So something had to give. So I just started doing stand up.
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. And we'd like to thank the United Soybean Board for the sustainable makeover of our podcast studio and for sparking discussions on greener Hollywood production. Check out the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how they pulled the whole look together. It's all on at Heartbeat Audio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
Here's the crazy thing. This is where I start to think, like, you know, not to sound corny. It's going to sound corny, but I don't want to sound corny, so I apologize for knowing that this is going to sound corny.
It's okay.
But as we just start to feel like you're a chosen one, right? And by chosen one, I mean it's untraditional, unconventional, and unpredictable, right? And what seems like all the wrong decisions sometimes, for some people, lead to the right decision. And that right decision of discovery of, oh, my God, I love this. I suffered from what you seem to have suffered from as well, which was I'm doing it, but I don't love it.
Yeah.
Right. I'm in this thing and I'm doing it. And a lot of people suffer from this, but they don't love it. And there's such a fulfilling feeling that comes with doing something that you love. There's an excitement. Like you talked about it when you said, you know, there's the energy. Like there's a, oh my God, the stand-up thing. You wanted to do
it.
Yeah,
it got me
Somebody
excited.
Else fell off, but you're like, fuck that. Like I like this thing. I love this thing. And when you give something your all, you see the benefit and the payoff from it. So when did stand-up get your all? When did you commit to giving it all of you?
Well, listen, I got I was hooked from that first night when I tried it, and I was never accused of being any good. And that took a while. Like,
what's a while? Give me a time frame for a while.
Loving it didn't mean I was good at it. It just meant I had some potential. And I tried it when I was like, you know, 18 and a half. I was pretty young and I couldn't get into some of these clubs. And then 19, I would say by 19, I knew that was it. I said, I'm going to do this good or bad. I just have to do this. And the problem is, a lot of people don't have the luxury. I was scrimping so hard that it was okay. If I could make 20 bucks at an open mic here or 20, if I did a set here for gas money, if I could really just skim by, I would be okay. I didn't have any lofty goals. So it's hard to say, it's just so hard to chase your dreams if they're so far-fetched sometimes, you know, because you just don't know. And I just said, there's no choice. This is what I like. I got to do it. And I just kept doing it. And you know, when you grind it out and try and you like something, you do better. And listen, I never liked my jobs. Of course, no one really does. It's work. But with that, as you know, it's sort of less work because thinking of a new idea for stand-up is like one of the funnest things in life. When you think of something, you crack a code of like going, oh, fuck, this could work. And then those are the few moments in life that are still fun.
How? Matter of fact, it shouldn't be how. When? When did you tap into the space where you said, this is now my career. I can support myself off of this. What was the defining moment that money was attached to the craft? I can quit my job. I can stop doing everything else. David Spade is now going to be a stand-up comic.
I have an announcement. Yeah, I have a stand-up. And everyone freaks out.
These are informative, David. I have to ask you these questions.
I know. I don't mind the questions. I'm trying to think if there's an answer.
Here's the crazy thing. It's not just for my listeners. It's for me. That's why I do this podcast, man. I have a high level of love and interest for understanding those that share the same thing that I share, a love for. Like, what was your journey? So I want to know, like, when did you get to the place where you said, fuck that, this is it?
Yeah, I think when I, it was earlier than I thought, because I was at Arizona State and I wasn't doing well in school because of the fraternity, which wasn't a bad thing. It just, that was my choice. But once I finished that in a semester, I said, I don't even want to go back to school. I just want to chase this other thing. And I chased stand-up, and I think that was it. Now, it didn't mean I made enough money. It took a long time. I always had another job. I was a valet, and then I was this and that. Worked at the skateboard shop. And then I was trying to get road work, but maybe make $400 a week doing an opening or middling. And then it just took forever to break in. And then I got to LA probably 2 years when I was 20.
Okay.
Still wasn't doing well, but was doing the improv. Got a movie. Got a small part in a movie because I was the improv.
Okay.
And I just didn't look like everyone. It was really not I was the best. It was, oh my God, this kid can play a high school kid. When the lineup was monster, you know, Jerry Seinfeld, Kevin Nealon, Leno, all these guys, Paul Reiser. But they were all like 35 New York comics. And here comes Pipsqueak. I got long blonde hair. I don't realize I don't look like everyone. And they're like, oh, this guy's interesting. You know, let's bring him in for something. And then they threw me into a movie. And you know, Kevin, this movie is called Police Academy 4. And a good one. And it answered all the questions from 1, 2, and 3. And so it was a trilogy. Unfortunately, they did 9 of them.
How many did they really do? How many Police Academies are they?
There was enough for 2 movies. They made it, I think, 8. But
is that the longest going? Is that second behind Fast and Furious?
I think it was the Fast and Furious of its day for sure.
I'm telling you, it actually may be the longest.
It stayed going on there. Do you remember Police Academy?
Yes. What do you mean? Okay. One of the biggest movies in comedies of all times that went to part 1, part 2, part 3. But I'm saying it continued to go.
And yeah.
There's not many things that have had that level of success, especially with longevity.
Police Academy 5 was called Spade and Hobbs. No, but what happened was Police Academy 4, believe me, I read the script. It was fizzling then. I think we could have pulled the plug. But I don't know they didn't put me in 5 and I was crushed. Because I made a movie and made $25,000. And that year when I got my tax return, I had made $29,000 because I only make 4 from stand-up for the whole year. And then I made, you know, that. And then the next year I plummeted because I had no movie. But I will tell you, Kevin, just so your listeners know that it is sometimes a tough road, that when I did the Police Academy, I cleared, let's say, you know, taxes. And I cleared 10.
There you go.
People don't know that part either.
Yes.
When they borrow 25, they're borrowing 75 because I got to make 100 to clear 30.
Absolutely.
So I clear 10. I come home thinking I'm King Cock, peacocking up and down Melrose, and I have to buy a car. So I give my mom $3,000 for some bills, $1,000 I pay some of my own bills. And I have 6 left. I got to get a car to be a stand-up. I could have gotten a tricked out Camaro. I could have gotten a Supra with louvers. But instead, I bought a fucking Honda Accord. I said, I'll treat myself to sunroof, but I got to just, it's not going to get any poontang, but I just got to get from A to fucking B. I always had a shitty car. They always break down. I just want one that starts. I buy it for $6,000 cash. I drive it to the improv and it's stolen within 1 hour.
You're a fucking liar.
I come out to show my comedian. I go, I am back to fucking zero. I don't have any insurance. I just did a movie for 10 fucking weeks. I have nothing to show for it, and I'm back to zero.
They stole the car?
Yeah.
What, did you leave the key?
I feel like they followed me. I don't know. I feel like they sold me, followed me, and just stole it back. I don't know. It was fucked. I was so down. That was my lowest point because let me just really make you sick. When I was there, Bobcat Goldthwait was in Police Academy. He was he's a great guy, really helped me out. And I got back, and when I was there, he had a director buddy. And this director buddy was like, oh, you have some heat on you. I don't even know what he's talking about. You got a movie within a year? And I go, yeah, it's just this. And he goes, you're going to be great. I want you to put you in my TV series I'm doing for Fox. Fox was new. I said, oh my God, this is my dream. So he goes, here, read these sides. You know, he gives me sides. I'm like, yeah, sure.
No idea what a side is.
And he's like, no, just look at it. And was reading a script like this. And I was so fucking horrible. And he goes, I can work with you. We'll make this work because you got heat. He was like trumping everything. He's like, I got to get this guy before he gets back and get something. So I get back with my heat. My agent went to ICM. So I have new agents. And they all sit me in a room and go, we're turning that down. You're better than that. I go, better than my own show on Fox? They go, you need to go to NBC. They've got Cosby. They've got all these shows. I go, but I'm not even fucking any good. Like, this is a trick, you know? This guy liked me. So turn it down, get my car stolen, go back to Bobcat. He lends me $6,000 for another car. Now I'm in the hole. Then proceed to go on 30 auditions where I bomb every single one and ICM drops me.
Wow.
And I go, I couldn't have been at a lower point. I go, wait, I told you I can't act. This guy was willing to work with me.
How old were you here? What was the age?
21, 22.
Jesus. But this is such a good story. And for my listeners, you know, when he says heat, he's referring to that's industry talk, entertainment talk. You know, when you're
a lot
young,
of attention.
You're new on the scene, everybody's watching you. You got heat on
and
you.
And everybody wants you.
Yes.
You got a couple things going for you. People start going, wait, is this the new guy? Is this the guy we're supposed to? Oh, and then that, it's like suddenly everyone wants you because they put me in a movie. So now they see me at the improv. They go, oh, we have to be the guy that gets this guy. And you know, you have phases in your life. We have heat. And then you don't. You're just cold and you're just doing your thing. And you hope you generate some heat again, get some attention going. But this, I had it, was unaware of it, came back, fully fucking fumbled it. And then, you know, my manager, Mark Irvitz, who's a great guy. He's at Brillstein, and you know how he saved my life almost literally? You know who he is. Great guy, and I'm still with him. But about 3 years ago, he says, oh, yeah, remember I was telling the story about it. I go, oh, I fucked that up, and then I was at ICM. And then I left ICM to go to Abrams Artists. They were a little smaller, and he goes, you left ICM? And I go, yeah, remember? And he goes, oh, right, that's what I told you. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, they left you. I go, shut up.
Shit.
He goes, oh, yeah, I couldn't tell you that then. I said we left because you couldn't have handled it. I go, I couldn't have.
What a manager.
What a great, that little move.
What a great manager.
Almost saved me from total collapse. I would have moved back to Arizona.
Well, I mean, look, you're talking about punch after punch.
Yeah.
You're talking about taking a consistent amount of body shots. And that's the fucked up thing about stand-up comedy and entertainment. This is the thing that people don't know. They see the success, but they don't see the road to it. I mean, goddamn, how do you eventually get to the point of success? What's the first big thing you book?
Well, let me step back a step, because I think you said you're from Philadelphia and you're probably big stuff was maybe going to New York. I'm from Arizona and everyone talks about moving to LA. I did. Everyone used to talk about it when they're drunk. I might go to LA. I might go to LA. That was the big cool thing. We're pretty close to LA. We weren't LA, but I did it. And so I had some respect for doing it, but it was such a beating. The other layer of insanity was going back to Arizona. And everyone's like, what are you doing? Why don't you have anything? I haven't seen you on TV. What's going on? Why haven't you made it yet? And I'm just sitting in like some shitty room in LA, like with two spots a week at midnight at the Improv going, why am I even doing this? Why, you know, it's just so hard to hang in there.
To question it.
And,
yeah.
And then finally, fuck, I don't even know what the thing was. I think I got an HBO Young Comedian special. And that's because Dennis Miller helped me. Gervitz and Brad Gray helped me get on it. It was a Young Comedian special, but it was funny because I don't know if you remember this. First, there's the Rodney Dangerfield one on HBO. If people don't know, that was like a huge one. Mm-hmm. HBO was the only pretty much cool cable game in town. They would have specials and they were fucking unreal. Eddie Murphy, you know, you remember all these things. And then they would have Dangerfield would have about five comedians, Jim Carrey, Kinison, Saget, all these. It was a big deal. And so they had a Young Comedians one. And so I was trying to get on that. And I missed it every year. I'd get close. And they'd put like Richard Belzer. And I'm like, I'm actually a young comedian. I mean, you know, come on, guys. But, you know, Belzer was like 77. And he's like, hey, I go, I think he's been discovered. I, you know, let's break somebody over here. So the next year I get it, but there's only five. And I was sixth. So I get the word, you didn't quite cut it again. I'm like, now I'm running out of, I just am like flatlining. And Dennis Miller is the host. He goes, I'm going to try to get you on. And then Brad Gray and Gervitz go, we're the producers of it. So they made him use six instead of five. Another great move.
Wow. Wow. I'm loving your story. I'm loving the fucking story. And here's the crazy thing. I had no idea. I had no idea about your road to glory.
You just see me walking around with my feathered hair.
Yeah, I had no idea, man.
Some Prada knockoff shirt.
You took your beating.
I took a beating.
You took your beating. And the move to L.A., goddamn, I can only imagine. I can only imagine the lows of just like, what the fuck, did I make the right decision?
And you don't really know anyone, and you're like in comics, and no one really wants you to do good. You know what I mean? You start to blow up, and people are like, fuck, I heard this guy's an asshole. And you're like, huh? Oh, me? But that's just the way it is. And you know, you had a few friends, but they're all on the road. You know, the real comics are working, and what do you do all day? And it's a rough, rough ride. You did it. In Philadelphia, was it the deal? You had a lot of clubs, though, but was the deal to make it to New York? Because Arizona didn't have many clubs.
Here's the thing. I couldn't move to New York. I couldn't afford to live in New York. So I drove from Philadelphia to New York every night.
Oh, and what's that, an hour or 2 hours?
2 hours. But, you know, once you
start
to do it.
That's a beating in itself.
A very big beating. Very big beating. So
if you bomb, you drive home the whole time just thinking, Jesus Christ, I just hate it.
Well, the bomb is, in relation to what you were saying, it's just the questioning of, are you doing the right thing and sticking to it, right? Like sticking to the decision to follow the dream that you have made your dream. All right, I now know what my purpose is. I'm going to keep going. And that's the tough part.
The hard part is patting yourself on the back, because no one is really a big support crew, because no one's seeing you every night. No one, you're doing these dinky clubs on your own and just not embarrassed, but you just kind of want to go grind it out. And you don't want to invite friends down because you're on late, or you might get bumped, or you're only doing 4 minutes. And then you got to, I tape them and listen to them, and you go, there's something there. You know, you just got to find a positive and go, I got that one, got a lot. I think I can work on that. And it's like a Rubik's Cube. Every night you go, I think I have something here. I think I'm good. Man, it's tough to keep that hype train going on yourself.
When did SNL come?
Oh, yeah. So, okay. So there's the Young Comedian special when I was like 23, 24. That airs a couple months later. SNL sees it. They call me up. Do you want to come audition? I fly to New York and audition. And, you know, same thing. You know, luckily, Brillstein Gray had a lot of SNL people. So they at least knew Lorne Michaels. They knew the whole system. And no guarantees, but at least they were familiar. Rob Schneider was on the special with me. He got pulled out. Tom Kenny was another comedian from San Fran. He got pulled out. So we had a big audition. Did not do well. Couldn't be more terrified.
What did you do? What did you do for the audition? Were there characters, or did you do?
No, that's why. You know, that's why SNL wasn't really on my radar, because now I wanted to be a sitcom guy. Mm-hmm. This is kind of how this whole conversation started. I wanted to be a sitcom guy at this point because I go, that's something I think I can handle. Be fun. Be in a scene. It's filmed in town. I didn't realize the beauty of filming in town, you know, until later in life. But I go, it's just like a fun thing I think I could do. And movies were sort of so big and too far out of reach. And so sketch comedy was not my thing at all. I thought I was kind of fast on my feet, but by no means was I doing a lot of characters. So I didn't really know why they wanted to see me. So I auditioned. I don't do that well, but Dennis Miller says, they're just going to look at your writing. And so I go, yeah, but I wanted to kill. I didn't kill. And then I thought, all right, well. And then Schneider and I got hired together. We both got called in to write for other people and maybe be a performer, but mostly write. And it was flattering, but who the fuck? I wanted to be on. I'm like, now I want to be on. I don't want to be in the behind the scenes.
Wow.
I got the bug.
Wow.
This is Luxury.
And Diallo.
The hosts of One Song. Shout out to U.S. Soy and the United Soybean Board for supporting this podcast and for giving our recording studio a sustainable makeover.
Just like music is made of notes and beats, each eco-friendly choice we make contributes a single note that completes the overall melody. That's why Heartbeat and U.S. Soy are teaming up to lead the discussion around greening Hollywood. We're talking slashing the carbon footprint of production with soy-based alternatives like soy-based inks for printing scripts, soy foam for soundproofing studios, and even biodiesel generators to power sets.
To see our podcast studio transformation, watch the Tears for Fears episode of One Song and see behind-the-scenes clips of how we pulled the whole look together. It's all on @HeartbeatAudio on YouTube, and the link is in our show notes.
I I got to be honest with you, man. It's just so dope to hear the discovery and everything that you're saying and just how this kind of lined up for you. Because the thing that you didn't think that you would be able to do, that you didn't really want to do, you were fucking great on.
SNL.
Yes.
SNL took a long time to get in and crack that code of writing a sketch and doing like characters. And I think I ultimately worked out, and I think it's looked back on pretty positively, you know, it is only because I sort of found a niche of being whatever sarcastic. But listen, even if you come out a one trick pony, you at least had a trick. Like there's people on SNL, they can't get shit going. It's just so hard. Then they leave. Then the next step is you leave. Now are you going to die off like everyone else? It's so hard to keep that treading water in your career, because you see people that are doing okay now, or you see people that are in the business that you go, they're pretty good. And you see some people like full of themselves about it, but you go, try it for 5 years, try it for 10 years. It's fucking brutally hard to keep those balls in the air and just to be somewhat relevant, just to keep anything going. The grind is not ending.
Well, it's the machine of SNL as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
A lot of people hear the murmurs, but it's hard. It's not easy. It's not an easy system to be embedded in and get out of. So, you know, the long nights of writing and pitching, they pay off for some, but not for most. And those that do figure it out, find success. And you, just from the writing and from the sketches, and like you said, the sarcastic side to a lot of your characters, you said like that was your trick, but shit, that trick put you in sketches, in multiple sketches.
Yeah.
It gave you a presence, and a strong presence on the show.
Yeah. They said, oh, Spade can do this. You know what? Spade can throw him in there. But I also had Dana Carvey there. He's the one I do the podcast with now. And he was sort of the king of the jungle there. He was a better version of me. He kind of looked like me. He was great at characters, great impressions. He played every president. He played every big star. If a star looked like Sandler, Sandler would play him. If he looked like me, Dana would play him, you know? So that was another beat down. That's why people, when they get well known, they're crazy, because they finally get somewhere where they get a couple beans in their jeans. But the road there was so tough. You go, God damn, I fucking made it. And you're like, yeah. And then you just collapse and go, fuck it. It's hard. So I was at SNL, another hard place where you're just trying to scrape by.
Well, you have relationships that have lasted, right? Like these relationships that you have made on SNL have turned into lifelong relationships, right? I mean, you and Dana, you guys, you do is it a podcast you guys do now?
Yeah, a podcast called Fly on the Wall. It's just basically Dana and I get people from SNL and we just talk about their experience, because we just made it where if you're a writer, a host, a cast member, or a music act, we can talk to you. So it's sort of, it's pretty wide net, because everyone's, that covers a lot of people, but it's fun to hear what they have to say. And then they ask us about it, you know, because we were all sort of in the trenches. I think Conan's the one that came on this week. We had Tina Fey last week. It's really fun because some of them I don't know well, some of them I do know well, some I was there with. We had Rock. I saw Rock last night, who loves you. And I said I was doing something with you today. Kevin Hart.
Yeah, that's my fucking guy.
He goes on and on. Yeah, he loves you. He goes, this guy sells tickets.
Yes.
I go, Rock, you sell tickets. He goes, no, no. Kevin Hart. I said, we were joking about how big you play places. And I go, there's these comics that play the biggest place. I go, Rock, you play big places. Some of these comics, it's like, they had to push two stadiums together for one show. Like, it's true that, yeah. By the way, I hear about these podcasters that are just crushing people. I don't really know. Are, you know, you're a household name. There's Chris is a household name. There's people that really sell and do well and have the huge fan base. And I get it. And then there's some I just don't get, because I'm not on the pulse of fucking the world of crypto and metaverse. But all those things are tied together. But there's guys that are out there selling so many theaters that I don't even know, you know, and I start to go, fuck, it's a new world.
It's weird how it happens. When it happens, it happens. But, you know, a following is exactly that, a following. And sometimes them fucking followings, they get bigger and bigger because of the conversation attached to them. And with us, within the world of stand-up comedy, funny travels fast.
Yeah.
Funny travels. The conversation of funny travels fast.
I'm as jealous as the next guy. And when I was on SNL, I was, you know, it's hard to watch everyone do great. And Sandler was blown up and Dana's always killing and Mike Myers. There's so many great people there when I was there. But it's hard to keep yourself in check and go, I'm pulling for them because they're my friends. I want to do well myself. And that's you know, in the comedy world, when I watch people that are good, I think a lot of comics do this. I go right up to them, tell them. Like, that's like a camaraderie where if you recognize game, you see two jokes from someone, you go, oh, fuck, this guy's got something going on. And then
that's so good what you just said, man, because it's what our world lacks, right? Like, yeah, we don't have enough of it. And rightfully so. Like, I think you made a really good point just now by saying, fuck, man, I'm watching everybody around me do what I do, and they're getting more success.
Yeah.
And it's very tough to be the guy that's not getting that yet, right?
Yeah.
And I remember there was a point in my career where I was watching, you know, I was watching Cat. I was watching Mike. I was watching Bill Bellamy. I was watching, you know, this other generation, or, well, I guess we're I was a part of their generation as well. But I was watching the baton get passed, and it just seemed like it was getting passed all around me. And you're younger. You think it's your time. You think that it should be you, but it shouldn't, because you're still learning. You're still getting molded. So when you talk about Mike Myers, you talk about Adam, you talk about Dana Carvey, you know, these guys were in such a fucking great groove and in a great thing.
Yeah.
And you're there, but what you don't realize is that you're picking up from all of that greatness.
Oh, yeah.
You're learning, and you're slowly but surely, you're strengthening, and you're getting better, and they're waiting for the fucking moment. Like, that ball's about to drop for you. And it did.
Yeah.
But I was a person just like that too, Dave, where I was looking at everybody else like, what the fuck? Like, what the fuck, yeah, man? When are they going to notice? Like, I am too. Me too.
Yeah.
Come over here and see this.
Because first of all, you can't say that those comics you listed are bad. The thing is, you go, they're good, but I'm pretty good. Like, it's not that big of a gap, but it's just not your time. And SNL, it took me the longest out of all those guys. I was writing, and then they wouldn't make me a cast member, and then I was writing, and I'm like, it's hard to write for Mike Myers. It's hard to write for other people, or, you know, Glenn Close comes in, or, you know, Tom Hanks, you got to write jokes for them and write sketches and not yourself. They tell you, no, it's not your time yet. And I'm like, this isn't how I pitched it. I don't know how to fucking write. But you learn, and you watch these genius writers, and you listen to read through, and you go, I'm just trying to figure this out of what works, how they write it. So it's how many sets and this, oh, that seems to, oh, and you need this transition. And you just start, if you pay attention and don't give up, you know, and then you start to make things work. And when I was doing this Hollywood Minute thing where I was making fun of people, and Lauren finally said, why don't you do that again next week? I like that. And I was like, oh, really? And this is when I was 3 years in and not getting on a lot. And every summer they're like, they don't know if they're going to bring you back. So I'd have to move back to LA, move out of my place. And then 2 months later, all right, they'll bring you back. No raise or anything, but I'm like, move back, carry a mattress, no Uber,
none.
Kevin,
none.
No, you know,
yes, yes.
Task Rabbit. I'm up there, you know, all I want is mattress. It got down to mattress, desk, legal pad, pen, phone, and that's it. You know, one bowl, one spoon. Because I go, I'm going to move again when they tell me they don't know if they're bringing me back. And then got on a little bit of run there, thank God, for the last 2-3 years. And then fucking Farley and Sandler left, and that was a bummer. I was like, I'm going to go one more year, because they were blowing up so big, you couldn't stop them. And I go, I think I could use one more year to figure this out. Did another year, and then went on and lucked into Just Shoot Me, a sitcom. You know, that was another one.
That's the thing. Is it luck, Dave? Is it luck?
I mean, that was me not really betting on myself. That was me strategizing, going, they will give you your own show. Any network at that point, leaving SNL, would have said, you can have your own show. We'll try it. But there was a guy, Larry Sanders' show, which was really good. One of their writers was doing a show called Just Shoot Me. They had shot it. It had a good cast. NBC liked it. They had shot it, and they got all the way to the fucking upfronts where they announced shows in New York, flew one of the girls out, Laura, and then that night go, you know what? It's four people. I think it needs to be five. We're pulling it from the schedule. And they were like, what? And so Brad Mark showed it to me and said, do you think you could add yourself to this? Because we need one more person in this. And then NBC, they really want it. And I go, I'll go with the one that's on the 1 yard line. Because you do your own show and it doesn't work, you lose your heat.
Yeah.
Our heat thing. You know, you might not get another shot. So I go, let me blend into one. I'm not like these other people. They're all good. I could do my own thing. And I think that's a safe bet. I'm the fifth lead, but it doesn't really matter because if you score, you score. You know what I mean? People will find you. So I tried that. And luckily that worked because it's not just me. It's like the writing and this, and the scheduling, everything has to work.
And your role progressed.
Yeah. And then I got in it more and in it more. And then,
yes, you progressed. How many seasons did you end up doing Just Shoot Me?
We did six. And by that last season, I got on the cover of Rolling Stone. I got on the cover of Entertainment Weekly. And as a comic, you know, it's hard to get on Rolling Stone.
It's very big. That was a big one. Massive thing.
And then that show ended and I went and did a couple more movies and stuff. You know, it's sort of like we have a similar path. It sounds like we had a similar upbringing there and then getting to this point of being in the showbiz and then covering some different things. I think you do more. You're doing a lot, but it's sort of hard. Everything's different, but all things are challenging and all things, if you think you can do it, that's fun. It's fun to a movie for me once in a while. And it takes it out of me, but I do like them. I keep fake retiring. I told Sandler, I go, no more movies. He goes, yeah, okay. And then about 6 months later, any more movies?
So what is that? Like, how did that relationship evolve to the creative space that it went in? You know, the one thing that I've taken from Adam, I'm a sponge. I take something from all the greats, yeah. Right? And with Adam... Adam is very, he's so loyal.
Yeah.
Very loyal, man. And, you know, in the world of, I think if you judge a person's success correctly, it should be judged off of the success of those around them.
Yeah.
Right? It's not just the one. And when you look at that pool of individuals that have kind of been a part of that circle, yeah. Like there's been a lot of individual moments as well, and I love that. Yeah. I love that it's not just about Adam, right? Like it's about the machine, it's about the circle, and making sure that everybody is.
Yeah,
we all got an opportunity.
He likes it. I mean, he got when I've done movies that work. Some movies don't work, but when we wrote, there's movies for sure that. He helped push along. Joe Dirt would never have happened without Adam. Dickie Roberts would never.
Joe Dirt's funny as fuck.
And it's one of those ones where you like, I have a lot of faith in it. And we think it's just a weird movie, but I go, it'd be really great if we could do it. It's just, it's not a slam dunk. You know, I'm not one of those top 12 comedic actors or stars of the world. You know, back then a studio makes maybe 12 movies a year and, you know, one's going to Tom Hanks, one's going to DiCaprio, one's going to Will Smith or whatever it was then. And then, to get in there is very tough. And Adam. Mm-hmm. And so to get one of those to make one of mine, you know, it's a lower budget, but it could be some big upside. Adam got Joe Dirt made after Warner's dropped it. I was at Warner's that dropped it and went in a turnaround and he did it. And those are the really big favors that matter. And then when it pays off for Adam, it's great for me too, because I go, he risked it. It turned into a movie.
He bet on me.
And he bet on me.
He bet
and, you
on
know,
me.
I'm loyal back. I'm going to bust my ass. I'm not going to be a prima donna on the set. I'm not going to cause any trouble for him. And then we still do that stuff. And then when it turned into Grown Ups, where it was just all melded together, where he goes, let's all do one together. Super fun. I wish we were still doing those because, you know, we're keeping the lights on at TBS. It's on probably six times a day, along with Benchwarmers and Joe Dirt and all these other ones. So,
but I love that it's the relationship of these guys that have so yeah. much history together, right? And I love that the storyline is almost parallel to the real life,
yeah.
right? Like you guys grown up together. You motherfuckers have seen each other go from boys to men. Yeah. And, you know, talking about Adam, talking about you, Chris, Kevin. I mean, the cast is one thing, but there's real, real, real relationships yeah. in there. And I don't know, I've always been envious of that. I love it. It's visible, like you said, that you're grateful for the opportunities that have come your way from him. Mm-hmm. And you know, you're a guy that just gets it. You understand it. But now it makes sense just hearing your story, hearing your road of trajectory of how you got to where you are. I think it's just dope as fuck. Stand-up comedy is still a thing. Yeah. Are you still fucking prioritizing? I know you go up. I know you still mess around.
Yeah, doing a special this weekend. Yeah, I think Rock and I are going on tonight just to practice. Mm-hmm. I go on.
Where you guys going?
I think we're just going to the store.
I'm a fucking come. going to come. What time are y'all going?
We're going early, like 8:30.
Babe.
I'm right here.
She probably not gonna answer me.
Oh, you're talking to your wife?
I gotta say it early while I'm on here because then
she oh, you let him get it in?
Yeah, I'm like, see, honey.
Say it's mandatory. Say spade. I promise spade. I'm
gonna, if you guys are gonna do it, I'm serious. I'm gonna fucking pop up. I'm going to pop up. Yes. Wow. I'm done at like 8, so I can just pop up. I don't see why not, right?
You got some energy, dude.
No, I don't. I don't have it. I'm hoping that I'll have it by the time I'm done today. You guys are going down there. I want to see. I want to fucking see it. I'll see what she says. We're supposed to have dinner. You know,
run it by.
Run it by the boss.
See what happens. Yeah.
See what the fuck happens.
Still doing stand up. I'll do a special. It'll be out in April, and then the podcast right now. So we'll see. It always goes in different phases. You know that anything you do, you're like me, that if you do anything, you got to put a lot into it. I don't want to half-ass anything. If I say yes to something, I want to do it right and try. I don't know if it's going to work or not, but at least I'm not going to fucking walk through it. I owe people that are paying me. I want to do a good job. So I'm doing my shit and just out there, same stuff.
I'll tell you what, man. David, I'm a fan. I'm a bigger fan today than I was yesterday.
Thank
just
you.
Because I didn't know that we had the similarities. I didn't know, you know, that we share those moments together. More importantly, man, you know, you've been around some shit. You have rubbed elbows with some of the biggest and best. And because of that, that shit rubs off. It's contagious, man. Your company is absolutely contagious the person that you become, the person that you are. And you've been in great comedic and creative company for years. And, you know, the coincidence, all right, we can say it one time. The luck, all right, we can say it again. But after a while, we got to realize that that's not the case at all. You know, the talented
person. But you know
people
like get like a break. If there's no game there, it can't last forever because you got to keep – every day is an audition. Someone's going to see you do something and go, oh, he's pretty good, or oh, he isn't. So you can't really walk through anything because there's someone that sees you for the first time or someone that goes, they judge you hard on 10 minutes of a movie you're in. You just got to keep it up all the time, keep up your stand-up, try to be good, and then hopefully it just keeps going. Me and Rock are like – this worked. So we just bought ourselves showbiz for another 6 months.
That's it.
That's about all you get.
That's it.
You got to do it again.
That's it.
What else you got?
Hey,
what else you got?
As long as you continue to create and recreate, we're in a place of good. Guys, this is what this podcast is about. It's about exactly what you just saw, what you just heard. It's about the understanding of who you thought you knew. What you thought you knew, you realized you didn't know. And now that makes you want to know some more. A fucking legend,
appreciate it, a legend
to the game and to the world of comedy, and I love that you've done it your way, and I love that David Spade has a specific style for him, to him, that cannot be duplicated. You got a thing,
that.
Man,
thank you.
You got a
thank
dope you, ass buddy. thing. When you talk about Joe Dirt, let me tell you something about fucking Joe Dirt, man. The goddamn tank top, the jeans, the character in general from top to bottom. Guys, if you have not seen Joe Dirt, educate yourself on Joe Dirt. Please educate yourself on Joe Dirt. Is that good, that funny? This is Comedy Gold Mines. And oh my God, what an amazing mind we got to get into today. We talked to David, the legend fucking Spade. And
you,
we heard a story that is one of so many trials and tribulations, but that's what it takes sometimes to get to the goal. David, thank you so much, man. I appreciate you, dude.
All right. Miss you already. Right. I'll see you out there, bud.
Comedy Gold Mines is a Sirius XM and LOL audio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, and Eric Weil. With Tastemakers Media, Emil Garner, and Ian McDonald.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Emmy Award-winning John Mulaney presents Everybody's in L.A., a special run of six live episodes created by and starring Mulaney that'll stream live on Netflix during the Netflix is a Joke Fest. The comically unconventional show will feature special guests where John Mulaney explores the city of Los Angeles during a week when every funny person is in it. Watch John Mulaney Presents Everybody's in L.A., debuting May 3rd live at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, only on Netflix.